Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste, I'm Divina Gupta. And on this edition, we're talking about geopolitical tensions impacting businesses and economies. We head to the Middle East, where Turkey has said it is halting all trade with Israel over the Gaza conflict until it sees more aid going in. Russia's energy giant Gazprom reels under the impact of the Ukraine war. And in the United States, Apple faces a China problem. Also in our corporate news, it's a big time during pandemic. It was a luxury exercise bike that is no longer proving as attractive. I'm talking about Peloton.
Not only do people want to go outside more, they want to be social. And we see this with the popularity of running.
More on that in just a bit, but first to the news we've got in the last few hours to the Middle East. Turkey says it is stopping all trade with Israel over the war in Gaza, citing the worsening humanitarian situation in the region. The Turkish Trade Ministry said all imports and exports will be suspended until the Israeli government will allow more aid to enter the territory unhindered. Let's go across to Victoria Craig, who is joining us from Turkey. Victoria is a journalist there. Victoria, thank you for being with us. First, tell us about this stand of Turkey because of the conflict in Gaza. What more do we know about it? And why is it coming with this sort of impact announcement now?
Yeah. Hi, Davina. Well, this is the second phase, as Turkey's trade ministry put it, of trade restrictions. This round follows a selected list of 54 goods that it announced back in April. It restricted things like steel products, cement, granite, construction machinery, aviation fuel, those kinds of things from being exported to Israel. Tonight, the Turkish government has announced that now all imports and exports to and from Israel will be stopped in the second phase. And as you say, that's until it sees Israel declare an immediate ceasefire and allow what it calls sufficient and uninterrupted flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Ultimately, Turkey says it wants to use all of the tools of diplomacy to stop conflict, prevent human loss and physical destruction. And in addition to the ceasefire, it wants to see the implementation of a two-state solution. But I think the key here tonight in this announcement is there aren't really any specifics about how this will be implemented. And some of this trade between countries isn't necessarily physical, so it can't be just turned on and off on with, you know, a flick of a switch on a whim. It's also worth considering how Turkish goods that make their way to the West Bank will be affected with all of the exports halted to Israel. One analyst I spoke to earlier this evening said that, you know, this sort of seems like quite a reactionary policy, maybe not one that's exactly well thought out, but we could see more specifics as the days and weeks go on.
Victoria, be with me, because you spoke about the impact of this policy announcement. Earlier, I've been speaking to Arda Tunca, who is an independent economist from Bodrum in Turkey, to talk about the volume and the value of trade that will be impacted with this.
It was making progress, and for a certain period of time, economic relationships were frozen again because of the tensions, escalating tensions between the two countries. There are so many fundamental differences in the way understanding politics and what is going on in the Middle East. There are some fundamental changes, of course, and Turkey is sort of trapped between different sides. You have Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, all those countries take different sides, and Turkey tries to be friend with all of them. And Turkey was sort of trapped in a difficult situation, in a difficult position. But now since what has been going on in Gaza, then the reaction came to a very utmost point, to a very crucial point. And economically, the relationship was making progress, but now it is stalled. And this is the end of a relationship between the two countries, politically and economically, for some time.
Yes, I was reading the figures of trade between the two countries is just below $7 billion. In fact, Turkey's biggest export to Israel. Now, do you see an impact of this decision on the industries in Turkey?
Not very deep impact. I don't think it is going to have any crucial impact on the Turkish economy. I believe that Turkey is going to find some other markets in order to compensate the loss of the Israeli market, because it, as you said, it is $6.8 billion. It's really nothing, I mean, compared to other trade partners of Turkey. 6.8 is really nothing, almost nothing.
For Israel, then, what does this mean? Because Turkey is the fifth largest supplier of all goods to Israel, including crucial construction components.
The biggest supporter is the United States of America, then maybe Israel might suffer to a certain extent in some business areas. But I believe that Israel is also going to find some other alternatives in a very short period of time. And I think Israel is going to find a solution quite easily.
That's Arda Tunca, independent economist from Bodrum and Turkey. And as I was mentioning there, Victoria, Turkey's biggest export to Israel are iron and steel. Now, the impact of is what Arda talked about. But do you feel that this is playing out more for domestic audience, for President Erdogan, with his conservative voters, that he's taken this decision at this time?
I think that's a major factor motivating these moves that we've seen. You mentioned the elections on March 31st, and the AKP, that's the president's ruling party, they lost several provinces. They lost a lot of power in those elections on a local level. And so it was really a message to the president that, one, the economy was a huge issue, but two, that the president has done a lot of really tough talk against Israel. But they say, these voters say, that he hasn't shown enough action on this. And so I think that's why we've seen this crackdown on trade over the last month or so. We've also seen the results of that play out in, you know, international geopolitics. President Erdogan was due to travel to the White House for a meeting with President Biden on May 9th. That was canceled last week with both sides citing scheduling difficulties. But it also comes after President Erdogan last month hosted the leader of the Hamas political bureau in Istanbul and was photographed hugging him. Of course, Hamas is considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. and European countries, so that likely didn't play well with Washington. So this is, you know, in an effort to show more of a physical, a tangible sort of reaction to what's going on, this is having geopolitical and diplomatic consequences as well.
Victoria Craik, a journalist from Turkey, thank you for joining us and breaking down this developing story on World Business Report. To the next geopolitical front now, the war in Ukraine. And this is impacting the national energy company in Russia.
Мы учимся, творим, созидаем, мечтаем. Газпром, 30 лет.
This is an advert for Gazprom, one of the Russia's largest companies. On Thursday, the Kremlin-backed gas giant reported its first annual loss in more than 20 years, a loss of nearly $6.9 billion. The company's sales to Europe, once its main sales market, have dwindled since the start of war in Ukraine. Sergei Vakulinka worked for a Gazprom subsidiary. He's an oil and gas researcher with the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center in Germany.
It was quite predictable. Gazprom was a huge company built to produce and export gas to Europe. The bulk of its revenues were from gas exports to Europe. As a result of the events of 2022, these volumes shrunk substantially. So Gazprom revenues plummeted and Gazprom couldn't cut its costs at the same pace. And the result is the big hole in its finances.
Could you tell us how much was it pre-war that Gazprom was supplying gas to Europe and how much has it been affected now?
Before the war, well, 2022 was a quite unusual year because Gazprom was reducing the amounts of gas it was selling to Europe, but the prices were skyrocketing, so Gazprom revenue went up as well. If you look at 2021, a more representative year, the proportion was something like 1/7 was from the Russian market and 6/7 was from the export market when we're talking about gas. In 2022, this proportion was even higher.
For now, when you're looking at these losses, what's the main reason?
The main reason, as I said, Gazprom gas sales halved and its costs stayed at the same level they pretty much were the year before. They've managed to reduce it extremely slightly by paying less for the gas transit services, but most of the costs were just what they were a year ago.
Which means that the cost of operation has remained the same, but the kind of money it's getting from selling gas, that's been going down.
Yes, it's the gas revenue that halved.
And why has it halved?
It has halved because the volumes of gas Gazprom was selling to Europe reduced by 60%.
Is it because of the war?
Two-thirds. Interesting enough, Gazprom wasn't sanctioned. There are no European sanctions on Gazprom's gas. But in the energy trade war that ensued in 2022, it was Russian government decision to cut gas supplies to Europe in a calculation that gas is so important for Europe that probably Europe wouldn't be supporting Ukraine in Russian-Ukrainian war. Well, that calculation didn't work really. But, well, supplies were cut and they're not coming back.
Could Gazprom make up for it by selling, say, oil to other Asian countries, including India and China?
Gazprom is developing its gas resources in East Siberia and has started this as early as in 2012. And that would be 40 BCM of gas, roughly a quarter of what Gazprom has been selling to Europe. This project was ramping up even since the pre-COVID times, but that's a poor replacement for European markets. For two reasons, the volumes are smaller and the prices are lower. Currently, Gazprom is contemplating building a pipeline from Yamal Peninsula, which was the main supply source for European contracts, to China. But A, this will take at least 5 years to build that pipeline. B, the contract hasn't been signed with China yet. The prices would be lower than what Gazprom was earning on European markets, and the volume would at best be a third of what Gazprom was selling to Europe.
We are seeing that the EU is giving member states the right to restrict Russian imports at the national level. For example, Austria is looking to speed up an exit from Russian gas. Now, if these kind of policies stay in place, will it be difficult for Gazprom to come back from here and recoup some of its losses that it's seeing?
I think that even if the war ends tomorrow, for example, even if there is a thaw and amending between Russia and Europe, even if Gazprom returns to European markets in some shape and form, it wouldn't recoup what it lost in any case. Again, for a number of reasons, because there's a wave of American and Qatari LNG coming to European market, but also because the writing was on the wall even before the war. There was a plan charted by Europe called Fit for 55 that foresaw a reduction of carbon emissions and of fossil fuels used in Europe by 2030. The paradise lost to Gazprom, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Sergey. We leave it there. Sergey Bakulinka, who has previously worked for Gazprom subsidiary, now an oil and gas researcher, joining us from Germany there. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, I'm not sure that many of you will be familiar with this sound, certainly those who use an Apple phone. Well, it is, of course, the sound of the alarm going off. But there's been a technical glitch this week on this because it hasn't been sounding. And Apple say they're trying to fix it. Now, they have more challenges because the company's latest figures have just been released. And with me to go through the headlines is Carrie Leahy, economist at the University of Columbia. Carrie, tell us how you're reading the results.
Well, this is one of those days where a company reports not very good results, but it's better than expected. And so the stock price goes up. And in this case, Apple released their results after the markets closed, and the prices are up fairly sharply. I mean, the numbers are lousy. Their revenue is down, their net income is down, and the like. And everyone knows their rollout of the latest iPhone was at best tepid, and they've lost business in China. But the fact that it wasn't quite as bad as expected has sent the stock price higher. And also, it's hard to differentiate some disappointing revenue and net income figures against the fact that this is the month they announced stock buybacks, and they announced very large stock buybacks, and so that generally helps the stock at least that day. So this is once again a day where results were bad, but not as bad as expected.
All right, be with me, Carrie, because you also have Rick Munaris from The Motley Fool, which is a financial services website. And thank you so much, Rick, for joining us. Talking about this share buyback, it's about a $110 billion share buyback, one of the biggest so far in the company. What does it mean, first of all, and why is it needed?
Yeah, so you're going to see the same. So as Carrie mentioned, net income declined, but on the actual press release, Apple said their earnings per share rose to a record level for this fiscal second quarter. And the reason that happened is because they basically decreased their shares over the past year by a little more than 2%. So it was able to go from 152 per share divided by fewer shares, the earnings, to 153. So you're going to see Apple, their earnings on a per share basis continue to improve. But yeah, it's a little bit of a parlor trick in that sense that they have money. Apple has always been cash rich. It's great that they're showing support. The stock has been basically a laggard compared to the Microsofts and the Alphabets over the past year or even year to date. So it's encouraging to see the share buyback, but I think we're all waiting for actual growth to happen out of Apple.
And that's the question, because we've been talking about the impact of geopolitical and trade tensions on companies and countries. Now, here's a classic example, isn't it, between the US and China, the sort of Cold War brewing from the trade front. Rick, it has impacted a lot of business of Apple in China, especially its iPhone sales. How worrying is that?
Yes. So Greater China revenue is down 8%. Apple doesn't tell you how much of that is iPhones, but that's historically half of its business and a little more than half of its operating profits. But business is actually lower, even lower in Japan, down 13%. The rest of Asia, 17%. So clearly there's a problem in Asia, but in Europe, the sales were up. And in the Americas, you know, just dipping slightly. So there is an Asian problem. It may not be just China. It may be more broad reaching.
Gary, how are you seeing this?
Well, it's hard to argue with Rick. He's led you through the numbers and saying it's more an Asian problem than a global problem. But you're looking for growth. And as he said, this and Tesla are the only laggards among the stocks that have been deemed the Magnificent Seven. So people want to see a return to not so much having a lot of cash, but as he said, some growth. And they haven't figured that out yet.
But some of the other innovative fronts, Rick, for example, generative artificial intelligence, where do you see Apple stand there? And do you think it's doing enough to beat its competition?
It has the money. Again, the competition, I mean, it's already, there's reports saying that it's going to work possibly with Google or even Microsoft's stake in OpenAI, you know, working with other partners. It clearly AI is going to be a beneficiary to Apple down the line. But they tend to be, you know, I don't think the market, you're not seeing growth out of Apple in that regard. And you're seeing a company that, while they are losing market share in China, and Mac sales basically were the only – Mac sales and services were the only segments of the business that went up. AI is more of a long-term bet, and I think investors want to see something happen right now. Okay. Apple is a company that with the iPhone, every – for the last decade, every 3 years, it's followed the same cycle. 1 year of surging sales when they have a revolutionary phone, and then back-to-back years. But
it did have
years.
A Vision Pro, isn't it? The headset, which was seen as this next frontier for Apple. Carrie, what's your reading on it? Has it been able to really deliver that growth?
No, I don't think so. I think you had this unbelievable gentleman named Steven Jobs who was able to figure out what products really worked, even when his whole staff told him he was wrong. And they're able to generate a fantastic business off of that. Now they're more in a custodial mode, and that's kind of hard for investors to live with. So I don't think that really has done it. And we all know that Meta has the same kind of problems. And so once again, the money may not be in AI, okay. May not be in those areas.
Rick, briefly then, because global demand, it says, is not picking up for Apple iPhone, especially as we've been talking about crystal ball gazing. How are you seeing the company from here on?
Yeah, I mean, a 10% decline over the past year in global iPhone sales is bad everywhere. But yeah, I think Apple, I don't think innovation's enough anymore. I think we're at the point, and you're seeing this in China, where companies like Huawei put out a superior phone in many ways.
But what about the other projects? For example, the car that it codenamed Project Titan, and it cost $10 billion. Is it in a position to carry on with these kind of experiments?
I think the likely failure of the Vision Pro tells us that maybe a big ticket item isn't Apple's way out of this.
Okay.
The car, I mean, we've been talking about this for almost 10 years now, and we're still not seeing the Titan. So I'm not remembering the Titans right now, to be honest with you.
Rick Munares from the Motley Fool financial website. Thank you so much for joining us. Carrie Leahy, economist at the University of Columbia, is still with us. But
yes.
Let's go around to the other company that's been in the headlines today, Carrie. Remember this?
Okay, Peloton, let's go. Hey, Sandra in Munich, 50 rides, great.
Max in Berlin,
well,
los geht's.
That is just motivating me at least to start some cycling or some sort of running or doing some activity, Carrie, here to exercise. But this was the pandemic era fitness darling, Peloton, which is now showing more signs of trouble, announcing that it will let go of 15% of its staff as the CEO steps down. Demand for their luxury exercise bikes, which can cost thousands, has remained weak as customers cut back spending because of the cost of living crisis. So earlier I spoke with Sasha Rogelberg, who is a retail reporter for Fortune, about more.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, over the pandemic, people were stuck in their houses, working from home. And the Peloton was a great way to get exercise, but we're not seeing that now. Not only do people want to go outside more, they want to be social. And we see this with the popularity of running. The Strava app doubled its users to 100 million in just 2 years. And not only is that more appealing to folks who want to be social, but it's also much cheaper than a Peloton, which could set you back, you know, $2,500.
But Sasha, one of the ideas was to get an app for Peloton and put subscription on it. It was paid subscription for its users. This idea doesn't seem to have taken off.
No, it doesn't. And we're seeing the company continue to lean into that strategy. It just announced yesterday a partnership with Hyatt to put its machines in 800 Hyatt hotels. It's done something similar with Hilton. And the logic behind that is really to increase engagement and awareness of its equipment and, you know, expand its consumer base. But that really hasn't been working. And we've seen even more trouble with the app. A couple of weeks ago, they kind of quietly did away with the free membership feature because it really failed to translate to additional paid subscribers.
And was this expected, especially when Peloton's business channel, which basically operates in hotels, had started underperforming the moment the pandemic got over?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see Peloton continuing to struggle as long as they try to expand their consumer base. Really, one of the biggest pitfalls it experienced was everyone who wanted a Peloton bought one, and now they really don't have anywhere to grow.
So for the next person who wants to get on this ride and head the company, what could be the next phase of challenges for them and where could growth come from?
So based on what analysts have told me, the company really should not be focusing on growth. In some ways, the company has been a huge success. They have a well-liked product. It's a good product. And they have a loyal subscription base of 3 million people. So rather than focusing on making that 3 million bigger, they should focus on retaining and making that group of people happy.
That was Sasha Rogelberg, retail reporter for Fortune. Carrie Leahy is still with us. Carrie, was this expected?
Yes and no. I mean, people have been going away from indoor working out to outdoor activities, as we already just chatted about. But I think the problem, once again, is you've got to keep your client base happy that you have. And it's probably going to be very hard to expand it with a very expensive machine to expand it upon. So I think they're going to have to find ways to make the consumer experience, so the ones that already have the Peloton, as good as it can be. But that's not a growth story. And firms that used to be growth firms, if they're no longer growth firms, kind of get punished for that.
Which is interesting, because it's not just Peloton. It's actually the same story being repeated with food delivery apps, even with Starbucks.
Oh, absolutely. Once again, particularly with Starbucks, it's an expensive way to get coffee. And if you begin to economize, because the economy in the States has cooled off a bit, you're just not going to get in line and do repeat business or occasionally walk in there. And of course, with food delivery services, people expected to be treated like they were crown princes of Europe with the kind of delivery they could get on 15-minute notice. It was just extraordinary in my neighborhood how many of these little shops popped up and how people expected to get groceries in 15 minutes. It really is extraordinary.
So basically, people are stepping out more, and they also are going through the cost of living crisis where they're trying to control their budget. Now, all this is also linked to the world's biggest economy, the US, and how the health of that economy is an important indicator is out tomorrow, which are the jobs figure. What are you expecting?
Well, I think like most people, we're looking for a pretty good number. We've been waiting for a number to be cooler or a smaller increase in the past. We haven't really gotten, if anything, the numbers have improved the last couple of months. But I would assume the number based on surveys is going to be up about 200,000, which seems to be a pretty darn good number this far along in expansion. But this is the biggest number, and this can really set the tone for the entire month. If it turns out to be disappointing and next month is disappointing, all the people that talked about the Fed not being able to lower rates this year will now say maybe they can. This is how important it is to the market and to the Fed itself. The Fed doesn't want to be a prisoner to every monthly change in payroll employment, but they can't ignore it if they get two or three slower ones in a row.
Absolutely.
And they haven't gotten that yet.
Well, the central bank of the U.S., Federal Reserve's chair, Jay Powell, has said it is likely to take longer for us to gain confidence that we are on a sustainable path to 2% inflation before they decide to lower the borrowing cost. That remains quite high for now. But Carrie Leahy, economist with the University of Columbia, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to World Business Report. Namaste.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.